Okay, so I'll be talking about the S matrix, and the S matrix I'm talking about here is the space-time one. I understand there have been a whole bunch of talks discussing world sheet S matrix and integrability, but this is the space-time one. So this is work that I've done with a linear combination of the various people, some of whom are in the audience here. So first, I'm going to begin by talking about the motivation. I'm not going to say very much about QCD, but this is one of the driving motivations of why we're interested in the space-time S matrix. And the answer is, of course, colliders, and especially the LHC. There's problems in phenomenology, important problems that need to be solved in S matrix theory. The other motivation is to try to solve n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. The maximally supersymmetric theory is, in fact, the most likely one that we can solve. And then the third motivation, which I'm going to explain a little bit more, is a re-examination of the question of whether supergravity diverges. Conventional wisdom, of course, says it does. Then I'll explain a little bit about twisters and what we learned from them. And then the main part of the talk is about n equals 4 super Yang-Mills amplitudes, this unitarity method, a way of constructing S matrix elements to either very high loop order or large numbers of legs. I'll explain some about the twister structure of this theory at loop level. And then sort of the key result will be higher loop resummation. Just in the last part of the talk, I'll explain about supergravity a little bit. So first, some motivation, basic motivation. So at this KITP conference, it was a three-month program on colliders in 2004, an entire month was devoted to the question of S matrices. It's something that's really central to the issues of colliders. I mean, it's pretty obvious why you collide something, you're dealing with the S matrix. And these are extremely expensive experiments. This detector alone here is $500 million. When you put that many resources into an experiment, clearly you want to maximize the physics you get out of it. And it requires a certain theoretical support in order to really get everything that you want out of it. And there's really been a lot of progress recently in perturbation theory, especially at tree level and loop levels. And it's based on this unitarity method, ideas from twisters. And I'm not going to talk about this, but there's on-shell recursion relations. So first, just to set the tone, I think some of you have seen this before, but this is always very amusing. So suppose you needed to calculate 5 gluon amplitudes in QCD or n equals 4 super Yang-Mills or any massless gauge theory, and you open up the textbooks and you ask, what do you get? And what you discover is this. This thing, if you want to know what fraction of the answer, this is only 1/25th of it. The only thing you learn from this is that it's some disgusting mess. You know, this actually, by the way, is the correct answer, at least pieces of the correct answer. There's polarization vectors in here. These are gluon polarization vectors, and then there's kinematic invariance. So you decide, well, gee, that's just a mess. But there's actually an amazing order in this mess. There's amazing simplicity that's hiding in that mess if you know how to extract it. And the key idea for seeing that that formula is actually simple is to use helicity. Helicity, I just mean circular polarization. It's freshman physics. There's circular polarization. It's written in terms of spinners because you want it to be a nice Lorentz covariant form, but it's really the same thing as circular polarization. It takes a spin 1 polarization, writes it as an inner product of spin 1/2 spinners here. It's written in terms of the momentum of the gluon, and then there's this auxiliary momentum. This is a null or a light cone momentum. It's an arbitrary momentum that you introduce, but you can demonstrate that it drops out of the final answers because changes in this arbitrary momentum are equivalent to gauge transformations. And the notation that I'm going to use are these inner products. So this inner product is just a spinner inner product like you find in the back of Bjork and Andrell, except these things are Weyl spinners. So there's a helicity projection in here. It's the square root of a Lorentz inner product. In Witten's paper on twisters, you'll find this notation. There was a reason why he needed this notation instead of this one, but it's the same object. Okay. Something very important that I'll use later. Graviton polarization tensors are just products of spin 1 polarizations. Now this seems like a triviality. In fact, in free field theory, this really is a triviality in 4 dimensions. It just spin 2 can be decomposed into 2 spin 1s. But as I'll show you later, and I think some of you have seen this already, is that in fact this is true for the entire S matrix, this property. This is not just free field theory. It's true for the complete Einstein theory. So if you now use helicity, here's what you get. It's the same information that I had in that big mess. This and this contains the same information. This first equation is that if you have identical helicity, and this actually uses an all outgoing notation, all lines are outgoing, then the amplitude vanishes. One negative helicity, the rest positive, it vanishes. If two of them are negative, you get a simple formula. And it doesn't matter where the location of the negative is, you still get a very simple formula. So there you have it. So now you're on track to believing that there actually is simplicity in that mess. Okay. And the way we do things is with one of these color decompositions. So we don't want to mix up color and kinematics. If you look at Feynman rules, color and kinematics get scrambled up and just kind of gets in the way. But this decomposition here is, in fact, the same one that's used in string theory. In fact, it's motivated by string theory. This is the open string formula, Chan-Payton formula. These are the Chan-Payton factors, and that's the open string partial amplitude. Go to the low energy limit, then you just have derived this formula. You can also do it purely in field theory by using group theory. So a little bit about twisters. I'm not going to say too much about this, but just to give you an idea and just point out really a key idea that's come from twisters. So what Ed Witten showed, twisters have been around for a long time. This is from Roger Penrose invented the twisters. What a twister is, it's actually so amazingly simple what it is. It's surprising. It's really surprising. So here we have an amplitude written in terms of spinners. These are positive helicity, these are negative helicity, or vice versa. So this is just an ordinary amplitude written in terms of these spinners. For example, here, right here, you see written in terms of spinners. And what you do is you take a Fourier transform, but it's an asymmetric Fourier transform. It's with respect to one of the helicity. So it's, for example, just with respect to the positive helicity spinners, not the negative helicity ones. And that is the twister transform. It's just a Fourier transform. And you might say, well, okay, what of it? Well, we'll see in a second. But the key observation that Ed made is that there are structures. When you do this Fourier transform, there's structures, and then there's a mapping you can make to a topological string. So there's a duality between topological string theory on one side and Yang-Mills theory, or I should say gauge theory. In fact, Ed was thinking specifically about N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, but at tree level, there's hardly any difference between N equals 4 super Yang-Mills and QCD. If you're talking about pure gluonic amplitudes, they're actually one and the same. And the key conjecture in Ed's paper was about was that in twister space, the amplitudes are supported on curves of a certain degree. And he said that the degree of the curve on which it's supported is equal to the number of negative helicities minus one plus the number of loops. So let's say this is a degree three curve. So this would be four negative helicities. And so if you take, in twister space, you take up one of the points off of the curve, the amplitude vanishes. So the amplitude in twister space, as a function of the coordinates of twister space, they have to lie on these curves. If they don't, then the amplitude vanishes. So there's a delta function support on one of these curves. And there are two different pictures that emerged. Curiously, they exist simultaneously, these different pictures. One is in terms of degenerate curves. So this would be a degree two curve, which is degenerated to two intersecting lines. Both of these pictures have a really very interesting interpretations, really fascinating one. This is most closely connected to the string, the topological string. This one is the one that's most useful for practical matters. Curious. Well, I see the version of this talk is not the one I should be giving, but okay. Oh. Yeah. I may have to reload this talk. That's really curious. Yeah, no, I did say KITP on it. Oh, that's really curious. Well, okay, I don't know. Let's continue and see what happens. Right now I'm just talking about tree level. I'm going to get to loops in just a couple minutes. In fact, in about 30 seconds. So this disconnected picture, if you look at it, it looks very much like a factorization of some kind. So that motivated Cacciazzo, Svercek, and Witten to think about factorization in field theory. And what they realized is that you can generate a set of rules based on what they called an MHV vertex, maximal helicity violating. So it's a vertex that it's a non-local object, so it's not a Feynman vertex in any sense of the word. In fact, you can open up your field theory textbooks and they'll tell you you're not allowed to do that because these have to be local interactions. But never mind that. We just do it. With one of these vertices, you can build up amplitudes with increasing numbers of negative helicities according to a certain off-shelf prescription that they pulled out of the air. See, they were driven by the belief that you can't have such simple pictures in twister space if there isn't a corresponding simplicity back in momentum space, back in with the spinners. And in fact, this is very reminiscent of light cone gauge. They introduce an arbitrary arbitrary null momentum, which they use to define the off-shell continuation of one of the legs in order to build up higher point amplitude. The organization is actually quite different from light cone gauge. But at least there's some echo of light cone gauge here. And in fact, this holds very generally. Once you have this idea, it's not just n equals 4 super Yering Mills, even though that's where the original motivation came from, thinking about the twister space and n equals 4 super Yering Mills, but it holds very generally in gauge theory. And the thing you can do with this is it's really fun. You can now do calculations on the back of an envelope. Okay, this is a pretty big envelope, but you just have to write small, and it's truly the back of an envelope. The entire calculation is right before your eyes. The calculation is you just write down these diagrams. So you just draw all the pictures such that there's two negative helicities on every vertex. See, every vertex has two negative helicities. And you write down all the possibilities for a given helicity configuration. And as soon as you've drawn the pictures, you're basically done, because you then write down the answer. There's a vertex here, and you write down, this is the vertex. It's this Park-Taylor amplitude. It's a MHV amplitude, but with an off-shell continuation, and you just write it down, and that's the entire calculation. That, by the way, is 220 Feynman diagrams. Okay, so that's really cool. And the thing that you the most important thing you learn from this is that general helicities at tree level, the scattering amplitudes are much, much simpler than anybody had anticipated. They're really simple, and they have structures that you can exploit. The origin of these structures. Oh, it's proved to be the right answer. Well, this one's definitely been proved to the right answer, because it agrees. It's been proven. It's been proven twice in two different ways. There's now a very nice proof that, it doesn't fit on the back of an envelope, but it's pretty close. There's a very elegant and simple proof of this now.
You take Q to be some definite value?
Q can be is any value you wish, as long as it's null. The final answer does not depend on Q. Yes. Completely unobvious. There's something like a gauge symmetry in there. You definitely can. Some choices are better than other choices. You can also, this actually, it turns out that what I'm telling you now is all outdated, but the key this key message remains, the simplicity, astonishing simplicity. Even one Feynman diagram of those 220 is a lot more complicated than this. And not only astonishing simplicity, but call it regular patterns that you can exploit. Okay. Where does it come from? Well, that I'm not going to be able to answer. But there it is. It does have these structures and these types of structures, and you can definitely exploit them in a very definite way to calculate. And to calculate better than anybody has done before. So now we're about to get to loops. So what about loops? So in 1974, Tuft proposed that we can solve QCD in the planar limit. Well, okay, it's been a while now. We haven't solved QCD. So like good physicists, of course, the right thing to do is find a simpler theory to solve. And the simplest theory to solve is N=4 super Yang-Mills. It has the maximum supersymmetry. It's a conformal field theory. So it has all, I mean, I don't have to tell you guys any of this, but what I really want to say here is that I am talking about the same N=4 super Yang-Mills that you're talking about. And this is the question, can we solve the theory? Excuse me? I'm at weak coupling, that's correct, but it's the same theory. We'll kind of move towards strong coupling in just a couple minutes. Okay.
But actually, there's something I have a very elementary question. What do you mean by an S matrix?
I mean a dimensionally regularized S matrix. I know everybody says, people say this over and over again, the S matrix doesn't exist in N=4 super Yang-Mills. And yes, it's true, mathematically it doesn't exist. Certainly the object I am talking about in terms of the S matrix is in terms of objects which are not physical. We're talking about the partons. But this is the kind of stuff we deal with all the time in QCD. If you look at the S matrix of QCD, it doesn't exist either. And in fact, not the perturbation theory I'm doing. See, the S matrix doesn't exist because, first of all, it's going to be infrared divergent. So it doesn't exist in the sense if you calculate it, it just doesn't exist. It's infinite. So we use dimensional regularization. That means that we're going to break the conformal symmetry. At the end, I'm going to restore it. Can we hold off on that? Because this is one of those things that we can go on for a very long time. Yeah, but I think it's, anyway, I think it's one of those things that's gotten repeated many, many times, so. Well, you've never asked me. So why don't we just hold off on that? Okay, so here's a little puzzle. Now, this is going to be heuristic, what I'm going to argue here. So if we look at larger Tuft coupling, we know that on the ADS side, we have weakly coupled gravity, and that's relatively simple. Yeah. Well, on the CFT side, you certainly have quantities that are protected by supersymmetry, and in many cases, those objects can be simple. And if you expect there to be a match, okay, that's fine. But there's also unprotected quantities, quantities which have no protection whatsoever in perturbation theory. So how could this be? So on the CFT side, you can imagine that the entire perturbation series, if you could somehow resum it, also has to be simple. Well, how could it be simple? So the guess would be that it's simple because it iterates in a way that you can resum it. Each order of perturbation theory doesn't really have new information. It's just a sum of terms, like an exponential series or a power series that you could somehow resum. So we could say, okay, so can we find this iterative structure? So what we do is we look at the scattering amplitudes. Now, these scattering amplitudes are well defined in dimensional regularization. They're gauge invariant, and they're independent of any field variable choice. They're actually quite clean quantities. So let's see how we're going to do this. So if you try doing it by textbook methods, you're not going to get terribly far. You'll be able to do certain one-loop things. Perhaps you could do some two-loop things, but you want to try to resum the whole thing. And you want to deal with things that are physical. You don't want to, sorry, I shouldn't use the word physical. I should call it pseudo-physical. Okay. By pseudo-physical, I mean that, for example, they're infrared divergent. So if it's infrared divergent, then it's definitely not a physical quantity. Okay. But it's a well-defined quantity that's gauge invariant and doesn't depend on your field variable choices. So the key theorem that we use is the following. Any amplitude in any massless field theory is completely determined from d-dimensional tree amplitudes to all loop orders. You don't need an off-shell formalism. It's completely unnecessary. Off-shell formalisms cause a lot of trouble because at intermediate steps you have unphysical quantities. And I don't mean pseudo-unphysical, I mean truly unphysical quantities. Okay. And those unphysical quantities greatly complicate your perturbation theory. You cannot see anything. Okay. Unitarity in d dimensions is all you need. It's not. There's a technical reason why massless is why the theorem refers to massless. It's really just a technicality, but it has to do with contributions of this form. So you have a bubble on the external leg. If it's massless, it's a zero. If it's massive, it's not zero. And then this thing doesn't actually have a unitarity cut for an on-shell quantity because there's no kinematic variable that you can do your trickery with analytic properties. So it's just a technicality. I think it's actually a technicality, but nobody has extended this theorem beyond the massless case, although I think it's straightforward, but someone needs to actually do it. The problem is truly a technicality that's stopping this. But
if you like to say that if you know equation of motion, you can reproduce hot-relative amplitude?
This is, I mean, the on-shell, the, it does come from the equations of motion. It's been, you know, things have been put, it's the equations of motion, but you put things on shell. So in a sense, it's even less information than the equations of motion that you would normally have in an off-shell formalism. Okay, and here's another thing that we use. So this is for doing one loop, which is actually kind of nifty. So at one loop, in fact, you don't have to work in d dimensions. You can work in four dimensions. And that directly ties into twisters, because the twisters live in four dimensions. Okay, and this is true even if you have infrared and ultraviolet singularities, which of course you do in a massless theory. All massless theories have these singularities. And simplicity, if you look at the results, they're surprisingly simple. Now this, in the earlier papers, we only knew about, we were only able to do the MHV one, the maximal helicity violating ones, because we didn't believe the other ones would be simple. And we don't use any of the standards, so we don't use green functions, Feynman rules, counter terms, Fadeyev-Popov ghost, BRST, off-shell superspace, you know, all the machinery, we don't use any of that stuff. Okay. Because the problem, well, the basic problem with this stuff has to do with the Green's functions being off-shell. If they're off-shell, that means that they're gauge-dependent quantities. They're not physical quantities. Okay. And the types of constructions, the way you build these things, and you know basic unitarity, that you can build up higher loops from lower loops, say two particle cuts, three particle cuts, and then we have generalized unitarity. Okay, this is not the imaginary part of anything. You can stare at it and say, what is that object? Well, it's defined in terms of the analytic properties, what poles you have present in the integrand of this amplitude. And you can use these objects, so these are on-shell objects, on-shell tree amplitudes, sewn together, and combined appropriately, you can build up any higher loop amplitude.
Well, non-coplanar case, how does the renormalization work?
Renormalization on-shell turns out, especially in the massless case, is a complete triviality. You shift the coupling constant, and you're done. And there's no counter terms, no confusion. And that has to do with the fact you're working on shell.
Why are there recycling
times? Oh, because you see, we live in California, so you know you got to recycle, right? You do a calculation. Let's say we calculated a tree amplitude. Okay, when you have Feynman diagrams, what you do is you say, okay, I've calculated the tree amplitude, done, throw it away, and then let's do the loop calculation. So then you start again. You take out your Feynman rules, build it up again. But we want to recycle. You take the loop, when you get to the loop calculation, you take your tree calculation, you feed it into the next one. You want two loops? Excuse me? No, you keep on doing it to infinity. You keep on recycling. The further you go, the further you can go. Okay. Unlike with Feynman diagrams, you can't do that because each calculation, you start at the beginning in a sense. There's a set of rules, and the previous calculation doesn't count, except maybe you become technically better at it. But the actual result cannot be fed into the next calculation. Okay, and we're going to keep on doing that. That's, in fact, I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's a very important, the whole theme of how you do any of this stuff is you have to recycle. Information you have, you don't throw away, you try to reuse it as often as possible. Okay, so let's do a one-loop calculation. The way we do it is we take the Park-Taylor amplitudes. So we're going to talk about the simplest case of two negative helicities, maximal helicity violation. The way we're going to do this is we're going to feed in the one-loop amplitudes, these tree amplitudes, in the product of into this cut, so it's the product of these trees, and then you have to carry out the loop integral. Yeah, I'm not going to explain exactly in detail how to do that, but essentially that's technically what you have to do. You multiply, keep the on-shell conditions, but you do a loop integral that's unrestricted, you know, just an ordinary Feynman loop integral. And what you observe is something really amazing on line one. look at the Park-Taylor amplitude. So two negative helicities, and then ask where's the loop momentum in these denominators. And you see it's here, all of these guys in the middle, there's nothing there, and then it's at the end. So in fact, you get a hexagon integral. You're talking about n legs. There's an endpoint amplitude.
All on an amplitude on shell? So
yes, they're on shell.
The square of the on shell.
Yes, that's correct. That's right. That's right.
Wait, do you really mean L1 bracket L1?
No, that's L1.
Oh, whoops. I definitely don't mean that. That's L2. That's a typo.
That's L1.
Yeah, it's definitely L2, L1. L1, L1 would not be happy.
Okay.
So what you notice is that the this guy here and this guy here carries loop momentum. So that's this guy here and this guy here, you can actually shake this guy. It actually doesn't carry loop momentum because the sum of these things is the sum of the external guys. So that you actually have only two propagators in here carrying loop momentum. So there's two here, there's two on the other side, and then there's a two cut legs. That makes six. So you're talking about doing endpoints by doing a hexagon. Now maybe a hexagon sounds like it's pretty complicated, but in fact, it's not so complicated, especially in the supersymmetric cases. You can just algebraically reduce this to a sum of boxes.
What do you mean loop integral on shell?
What I mean is you ignore the fact it's on shell and you integrate it. We'll have to
propagators? You have propagators?
I see, I'm not really explaining how the method works. I'm just going to talk about, you know, kind of vague, but afterwards I'll explain to you exactly why this works and what the trickery is.
Continue the on-shell amplitude to off-shell?
That's basically what you do, but technically all you do is you take the on-shell amplitude, okay, and then you write this in terms of Feynman propagators. You just shake up this denominator so that the Feynman propagators are explicit. And then at that step, you say, they're off-shell. Okay, now, you've made an error at that point, but the question is where the error is. And the point is that the error that you've made by saying that is in channels which you're not looking at right here. It's in the other channels. So you can reconstruct the information that you've lost by looking at other channels. And I'll explain that more precisely after the talk, if you don't mind. And in fact, we've done the MHV amplitudes, endpoints, and n equals 4 super Yang mills. So it's these scattering amplitudes. These things are infrared divergent quantities. In fact, they carry, like here's an example, they carry, in fact, the same infrared singularities you find in QCD. These infrared singularities of the n equals 4 scattering amplitudes are, in fact, the worst parts, the most divergent pieces, are in one-to-one correspondence what you find in QCD. Well, in this case, n equals 4, there's no ultraviolet in this case. In general, it's actually not so hard to keep track of what's what. Renormalization for on-shell, if you're working completely on-shell, is actually really simple. There's really no problem to keep track of this stuff. There really is no problem with that. A priori, you know what all the ultraviolet singularities are. As I'll explain, also a priori, you know what all the infrared singularities are, but that'll take a little bit, a few more transparencies. So what we're interested in, in these papers of maybe a year ago, we're interested in the twister space structure of these n equals 4 amplitudes at one loop. What is the twister space structure? Well, the way you can do it is you can just calculate these fellows if you have the right technology, and it's the unitarity technology. So here's an amplitude, say 7 points, and for amusement, it happens to be equivalent to 227,585 Feynman diagrams. Of course, that count is just for amusement because, of course, we don't do it by Feynman diagrams. And it's also a little bit misleading because actually what kills you is not the 200,000 Feynman diagrams, it's one of them. It's the hexagon. No, heptagon, sorry, the heptagon integral. If you had to do that as a Feynman diagram, you'd be quite unhappy. So the case of the three nearest neighbor minuses, that was worked out by Brito, Cacciazzo, and Feng, and then I think it was, I can't remember, it was a week later or thereabout, we worked out the rest of them. But to get the full twister space structure, if you want to know what the twister space structure is, you actually need endpoints, because 7 points are too few points to actually map out what the structure looks like. I'm going to draw a picture of what the coefficients. It won't be the full twister space structure for reasons that I don't completely understand. Nobody has worked out the full twister space structure, but okay, it's the twister space structure of the coefficients of these integrals. So there's a basis of integrals written in terms of polylogarithms. These are known functions, and the amplitude is completely determined by a set of coefficients. Here's an example of one of those coefficients. It's written in terms of these inner products. These coefficients have a certain twister space structure, and the question is, what is their structure? And
the
they're the kinematic, all the kinematic invariants. I'm suppressing.
So how do you know the difference between
these? These are boxes. Yeah, it's a collection of, it's a basis of integrals. The C's are a collection of rational coefficients. These have the polylogs in them. And the answer is actually very, very pretty. All the coefficients lie on these, have support on exactly these types of pictures. And these are inherited from the tree-level pictures because of this unitarity method. You're building one loop out of on-shell tree objects. So if you had a property like intersecting lines, then you shouldn't be too surprised that this will get inherited very directly by the one-loop amplitudes. And there's various proofs of properties, actually, like, for example, all these things lie in a plane, and the way these points lie has to do with what integral you're talking about, and in fact, the generalization, as you increase the number of negative helicity legs, you just get more and more kinks in these pictures. It has a very beautiful structure. I'm talking about here the twister space structure of a coefficient, which is not the same as the twister space structure of an amplitude. But the information is there for anyone who wants to sit down and work out now the twister space structure of the amplitude. It's very clear that there is, at loop level, there's more twister space marvels awaiting discovery and exploitation. And I think that, you know, pictures like this must make you start thinking about twister string interpretations pretty quickly. So now let's go on to higher loops. So that was one loop, arbitrary numbers of legs, the kinds of structures that you find. So what about going on to higher loops? Well, the basic trickery is it's exactly the same. We're going to use this unitarity method. There's a basic formula that the sum of all states in the n equals 4 theory crossing the cut of the tree amplitude times the tree amplitude gives you back a tree amplitude. That's a crucial formula because you can see what you can do with it. If tree times tree gives you a tree times some propagators, you just do it again and again and again and again. Right? That's the basic trick. And in fact, this amplitude, if you use this formula, you get an amplitude in terms of a scalar integral. These guys here are the two propagators of the scalar box. The other two are the cut lines. So that makes a total of 4 propagators in the integral. Giving you a box. And in fact, this agrees with the low energy limit extraction of n equals 4 super Yang Mills scattering obtained by Green, Schwartz, and Brink. So Green, Schwartz, and Brink did this, 20 years ago using a superstring, taking the low energy limit. This is the result they got. It's the same result. And now, right, we're back to recycling. Oh, I don't have my recycling picture, unfortunately, but now we recycle. If you can do it at one loop, you do it at two loops, because tree times tree gives you back a tree. So these two particle cuts can be iterated. And in fact, you can also do the three particle cuts. The answer you get, now this is in terms of an integral, scalar integral, so this is still not the full answer. It's just something to be integrated, has this very clean form that the planar n equals 4 super Yang-Mills scattering amplitudes in dimensional regularization have the form of a prefactor proportional to the tree and then two integrals. This is just the picture of that equation. I guess this is, there's an equal sign here.
This is n equals 4.
This is still n equals 4. By the way, this is very closely connected to QCD. You can take, in QCD, you can identify exactly the same structures. If you take the QCD amplitude, and what you do is you change the dimension up to 10 dimensions, and you make it n equals 1 supersymmetry by just readjusting the fermion content and the color content, then you're back to, then compactify, then you get n equals 4. So you can always extract this answer straight out of QCD. So you can think of this in a very direct way as a piece of QCD. Okay?
So these two diagrams are independent of the helicity and
the helicity? This is independent of the helicity. It's always... I'm sorry.
Y functions independent of the...
Oh, yeah. These are scalar box integrals. These are analytic functions in terms of the Mandelstam variables, S and T. No, there's a non-planar, there's a kinematic, there's a subleading 1 over n. There's a 1 over n non-planar guy. I mean, there's a diagram, a structure like so. What am I drawing here? Sorry. There you go. So there's a non-planar contribution that's down by 1 over n. Okay, that, in fact, has very similar structure. You just replace it with a subleading with a diagram that looks like that, and it's the same thing. But I'm not going to talk about subleading color. And I say non-planar is similar, but I'm not going to talk about it. And the reason why I'm not going to talk about it is because we have not found an iteration of the non-planar, only of the planar. And there are good reasons to believe that the non-planar is quite a bit more complicated. But you see, you can keep on going. There's three loops. I mean, so far, perhaps you should not be so impressed, because these are integrals which need to be done. These are non-trivial integrals.
These integrals of what? The scalar?
This is like a scalar phi cubed. This is exactly the same integral you would find in scalar phi cubed here. In this case, it's scalar phi cubed, except there's a numerator factor, which I kind of pulled out of the integral. There's a non-trivial integral that needs to be done. Well, these are all non-trivial integrals. And in fact, there's a pattern. You can make a guess. If you're in the guessing game, you can make a guess of what, in fact, the n-loop guy looks like. 4 points, n-loops, is just a simple rule for adding in new, going up to higher loop order. And that's based on the analysis of the cuts. Okay. Just a guess, but... Okay, so we're interested, we're not interested really... I mean, this is all very nice, but we're not interested in terms of scalar phi cubed. We're interested in the thing itself. I mean, the amplitude is an analytic function, not a known analytic function, not some unknown. But very luckily, someone has done this integral. Volodya-Smirnov has done this integral, these two-loop integrals. Well, if you're armed with the integrals, I mean, the values, and you have your intuition and we had some evidence from things that are called splitting amplitudes, then, in fact, it's a very simple matter to check for the iteration. You need to be armed with some polylogarithm identities, but you find, by evaluating the polylogarithms and applying an appropriate set of identities, these things take up pages. These are actually quite complicated objects, but the net result is very simple. The two-loop guy is, in fact, an iteration of the one-loop guy, This is one loop, and then there's a constant here. And this is the one loop, but there's some peculiar shift in terms of epsilon. This is still dimensionally regularized. Right? These are still infrared divergent.
So the m's depend on epsilon too?
They depend on epsilon. The m's depend on epsilon, and they depend in a non-trivial way on the polylogarithms of the Mandelstam variables.
They're using an M4 one loop as a very big
No, that one is not so bad. But if I were to actually expand it up. Almost. You see, M divides out the tree. Otherwise, there'd be some screw up here because of the way it gets squared. So M divides out the tree.
So just as M4 one loop contain all the powers of epsilon?
This is all powers of epsilon. The formula that I wrote here is only valid through order epsilon to the zero. This formula does not work at order epsilon. Okay. And it's quite a bit more complicated than it looks because of the fact that these order epsilon terms in that formula can strike 1 over epsilon terms, and those are actually quite a bit more complicated. I didn't include those because that gets quite a bit more complicated. And the formula for this two loop is quite complicated. Each individual contribution is much more complicated than the entire answer, but there's a non-trivial set of cancellations between these two integrals. And so there you have it. It iterates. So you say, well, gee, that's pretty cool, but clearly this is not going to work any higher, right? This is not going to work to higher loops.
But there's a shift in epsilon?
Excuse me?
Do you understand?
I understand why it has to be that way, all right. It has to do with the infrared singularities. It's basically that this formula is nothing but a formula of infrared singularities, which a standard formula which has, in fact, this shift, and then it's plus finite constants, and there's some finite pieces in here which are completely unaffected by that. So this really is just repeating the formula of infrared divergences. So it's clear why that has to be that way. Let's go on before we get to higher loops. To really believe a formula like this, what you have to do is go on in loop order. But before I do that, I'm going to talk about endpoints, two loops. So no one has succeeded in doing a 5-point, 6-point, etc. But we have tricks. It's the analytic properties. You know, it's like I said in the title, the S matrix reloaded. In the 60s, the analytic properties of the S matrix. In a sense, people thought it was all the physics. Well, we're using analytic properties left and right. The key analytic property we're going to use to go to endpoints is not by calculating, but by understanding the analytic structure. The properties, as two gluons become collinear, there's a factorization. That factorization is well understood. What we needed was to calculate the splitting amplitude, the two-loop splitting amplitude. That's what we did in that paper. Armed with the two-loop splitting amplitude, you can then write down an ansatz, which satisfies all the factorization properties in all channels, not just the collinear ones, but all the multiparticle ones. MHV amplitudes, the maximal helicity violating case, does not have multiparticle poles, so that makes life very simple. And then you just have to get the splitting function, the splitting property, to work right, and this ansatz has that property. And if you look, you'll say, wait, you didn't do anything except change the four points to n points in the formula. And that's correct. That's all it is.
You're assuming that this collinear behavior has a unique solution?
It's fully understood. I see what you mean. That's right. So you know what's fully understood is what the property is. But you may ask, what about inverting it? But if you know what... I don't have a proof, at least what we did here, but I can just say we have never been wrong. Not about this. Take that as a proof, if you wish. Or don't take it as a proof. It's very difficult to write down an analytic function with the right properties. I think actually today, based on what was done in the last 3-4 months, you can probably even turn it into an honest proof. Okay. It's actually a very standard trick, this kind of trickery. This is done all the time to generate new amplitudes. Now, the key question is about higher loops. Okay, so you know, maybe this iteration is just some accident of two loops, and it doesn't go on, and okay, that's the end. So clearly, what you really need to be convinced, at least what we needed to be convinced, was three loops. On the other hand, if you're going to do a three-loop calculation, you better believe it's true. There's no fooling around here. So I'd say actually the key ingredient in all of this is to be a believer. If you don't believe, you'll never get there. So we have the integrand. See, there it is. There's the integrand. You have to integrate this fellow. It turns out our friend Volodya Smirnov had already integrated one of these. He'd already done this one. So there was one more integral. Well, we had a lot of trouble stopping him from doing this. He said it was like a drug. So we were able to evaluate these integrals. It's actually a reasonably complicated function. It's several pages of functions which are known as harmonic polylogarithms. It's a set of functions defined by Remedy and Vermazarin. The important thing is that you have a basis that you can work with. So if you're looking for an identity, like this identity here, you have a basis that you can work with that you can, you know, compare left and right-hand side, and you can use some number of harmonic polylogarithm identities, actually hundreds of them, in order to set, line up both sides so that you can check it. And in fact, it's true. And this is by explicit computation. And the best part is we... Oh, there's a paper. No, there's a paper for it. See, people who do QCD do this kind of stuff for a living. This appears anytime you're doing one of these two-loop, three-loop computation. There's some integral that you have to evaluate, so it's very well studied. So the where you get it from is a paper of Remedy and Vermazarin, and there's also Germann, and I've already forgotten exactly the list of people who've constructed these things. But it's stuff you look up.
Can you give us an example, one of these identities, just to amaze us?
Okay, since I don't happen to remember the harmonic polylogarithm identities anymore, but since ordinary polylogarithms are a subset of harmonic polylogarithms, I can remember one. On my computer I have. But a typical identity might be something like this. And then maybe there's some pi square term, but it's some set of identities like this. And you typically need these identities because the identities are all of that form.
What's the definition of
LI2? This is the integral, LI2 is of x is equal to integral from 0 to x of log of 1 minus, or log of x, 1 minus x. The harmonic polylogarithms, they're built out of exactly the same types of integrals, except it can be plus minus, or it could be x in the denominator. So the harmonic polylogarithms, ordinary polylogarithms, are built by iterating integrals over and over again by sticking a 1 minus x. Well, let me call this. Ordinary polylogarithms are constructed by iterating these kinds of functions over and over again. So the next time you'll do an integral again with a 1 minus t, and that'll give you a third order and a fourth order. Harmonic polylogarithms are very similar, except that the range of denominators you can have is larger. You can have 1 minus t, 1 plus t, or you could have T.
So polylogarithm of x to the n of the sum on n,
yeah,
of the infinity of x to the n over n to the j.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Are these harmonic polylogarithms also?
Yes, they have. They have. They can be written in terms of a sum that is very reminiscent of the ordinary polylogarithms.
Define them as an infinite series in
X. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But I guess my question was really, did you by hand look at hundreds of...
No. It's all done by computer.
Yeah.
No.
I was wondering how you're
organizing them. Sorry, organizing what? Anyway, it's all done by computer because... There's a lot of them. You have to go up to sixth order. I mean, there's a lot of polylogarithms. That's the first thing you got to remember, because you're going up to six. It's a sixth order polylogarithm. And there's a lot of polylogarithms because, you know, it's all the different possibilities of what you can put here. So at each step, there's three of them, three possibilities, and then you move upwards, and you have to go. In our case, you have to go to sixth order. There's really a lot of polylogarithm identities, but these are all, it's all very systematic. In fact, after the talk, I can show you my entire table if you wish. Okay. So it's actually quite amusing. It's such a complicated calculation with such a simple result. And like I say, faith was the key. To believe that it's going to actually converge to something this simple. In this formula, there's some numbers here which I'll talk about. Actually, I say I need to hurry up. There's some numbers here which are actually quite interesting. These are anomalous dimensions here. Let me just move forward. Okay. See, now we're on a roll. So we got three loops, 4 points. So now let's go to three loops, n points. And the way to do that is very simple. Well, okay, we don't have the splitting function, the splitting amplitude. We have not calculated it. But since everything else is iterating so nicely, it's a pretty good guess that iterates very nicely. And then immediately you can write down n point three loops. But then you get greedy, and you say, Well, now that you actually have it up to three loops, you can actually inspect the structure. And immediately the thing you think of is that it exponentiates. So you just ask, can I write it as an exponential? And that, in fact, is the way it works. But the key observation for doing it quickly and efficiently is to realize that through three loops, the iteration that you're dealing with is exactly the same formula for the iteration, the known iteration of infrared singularities. This is completely and totally beaten to death and understood in QCD. And in n equals 4, it's just a special case of the general formulas. In fact, it's much simpler because the beta function vanishes, so the formulas degenerate to much simpler objects. But in all cases, it's an exponential. Infrared singularities always exponentiate. It's a well-known fact that's used constantly in QCD. And they have this formula in terms of something very nifty. They tell you the name of these numbers. There's some numbers that appear here. They tell you that one of the constants that appears in here is an anomalous dimension. And that anomalous dimension has many names. It can go with the name of cusp anomalous dimension. That's the cusp of Wilson loops. The soft anomalous dimension. It's called also the high spin limit of the leading twist operators. It's called the high moment limit of the Altarelli-Parisi kernel.
Is alpha s coupling constant squared?
Alpha s, yes. Oh, this is the Etouffee coupling, written in some very peculiar way. But anyway, that's the Etouffee coupling. Okay. And this anomalous dimension, it's known in n equals 4 up to 3 loops. In fact, we've recalculated it. It can be extracted. These are the anomalous dimensions for a given spin J, and it's the coefficient of the logarithm for large J. So it's something that can be extracted very directly from the leading twist operators. A few comments. We agree with the extraction that was done by Kotikov, Lipitov, and collaborators, Kalov Short. They had a very clever idea, a very interesting guess, which is clearly correct, of how to extract the n equals 4 result out of the QCD result. So the QCD, you know, one of the important points that I'm making here is that n equals 4 and QCD are maybe not twins, but they're cousins. Information from one, or an object that you can find in here, is in one-to-one correspondence to the objects that you find in here. In fact, it's this anomalous dimension. Their idea actually has to do with what they call, well, they didn't call it leading transcendentality. They called it leading complexity. But anyway, it's just the contributions with the highest transcendentality, which I mean the highest powers of zetas, like zeta functions that you find. It also agrees with this very beautiful result of Matthias Staudacher on using a beta ansatz in n equals 4 to obtain these anomalous dimensions. He needs to tell you this, but he has a very beautiful result for all orders, an ansatz, a guess for what it might look like.
So do you actually get it for finite J or for infinite J?
We get it for infinite J. We only know it for infinite J, based on our calculation. That's the thing that appears in our calculation. To go to higher number of legs, I think you were asking, you know, did we do it correctly? Because, you know, it's based on a guess on the collinear behavior. Okay, I claim we never make a mistake on that, but clearly you want a proof. But there's a recent paper from Cacciazzo which points towards a way of doing that. See, I'm really running out of time. Okay, so far I'm talking about infrared divergent objects. I've broken the conformal symmetry because I have taken the dimensional regularization parameter away from D equals 4. So of course, in that case, it's a well-defined object. But let's talk about going back to D equals 4. So what you have to do is take away the known infrared divergence. If you had a physical quantity, if you had a scattering of physical states, not these partons, then these infrared divergences drop out of your answer. The infrared singular parts are not the physics. They cancel between what's known as the virtual contributions, which are the only contributions I've been talking about, and the real emission contributions. But the infrared singularities are very well understood. We use the knowledge from QCD to subtract out the infrared singularities from our virtual contribution. And what you find is a very beautiful formula after you take D equals 4, epsilon equals 0. And the formula is a true iteration of the one loop in terms of the anomalous dimension and some constant whose name I don't know. I suppose we should name it. But anyway, this constant just gives the overall normalization of this finite remainder.
I'm sorry, what is script help sub n supposed
to be? This is the endpoint. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm rushing too fast here. So we've taken the scattering amplitude. We've taken away the infrared divergences. You're left with a finite remainder. This thing is an endpoint, the finite remainder of the endpoint scattering amplitude. It's a very complicated object in terms of polylogarithms. At endpoint, it's some very, big thing relatively big thing. written in terms of polylogarithms, functions of the kinematic invariant. And it's not in any special kinematic limit. It's the full thing after subtracting the infrared divergence. It has this very beautiful exponentiation for the n equals 4 theory. This is a completely known object here, this F1. It's a one-loop finite remainder. I guess I should say it someplace. But anyway, we're talking about the maximal helicity violating case. There's the anomalous dimensions, and then there's some other constant which gives the overall normalization. Yeah, was there a question? Now, whatever's going on here, I think, you know, I certainly don't have any proof or deep understanding, but it's very clearly connected to integrability, this formula. At the very least, you can see this anomalous dimension, which can be extracted from integrability. Now, I can either quit now and not talk about supergravity, or I can talk about supergravity, so you have to tell me.
Yeah.
Okay, supergravity in 5 minutes. N equals 4 theory and N equals 8 supergravity are very closely connected in perturbation theory. And it's through these Kawai-Lamon pi relations. These are tree-level relations. So what these relationships tell you is that any gravity amplitude can be re-expressed in terms of Yang-Mills amplitudes. And the specific theory you have on this side is inherited from the specific theory you put on that side. So N equals 8 you get by 2 N equals 4 amplitudes. Or N equals 1 supersymmetric theory you get by N equals 0, meaning pure gravity with an N equals 1 theory. N equals 0 meaning pure Yang-Mills. Or Einstein gravity you get from two pure Yang-Mills amplitudes put together. And this works at endpoints. The way this can be proven through string theory, that's the Kawai-Lamon pi relation. They proved it in string theory. You take the low energy limit, and now you have these relationships. And it has nothing to do with the gauge group, because these are color-stripped amplitudes. So you take the color factors, throw them away at these partial amplitudes, you now build a gravity amplitude. Okay, so how are we going to do supergravity loops? And now I've got plenty of recycling signs. The idea is to not throw away your previous calculations, but to reuse them. So first thing I want to say about supergravity loops is I think that that this really needs to be reinvestigated, especially for n equals 8 supergravity case. And the problem is that all the previous studies, including the one that I did, they rely only on supersymmetry. But it's clear there's a lot more going on in these theories than just supersymmetry. I mean, just let's pick twisters. I'll show you in a second the property of gravity amplitudes, which maybe gives you some pause that maybe there's something much more going on here. Or these Kawai-Llewellyn pi relations, the way that gravity amplitudes inherit properties of Yang-Mills amplitudes. Well, N equals 8 is the right one to be looking at. It certainly has the maximum symmetry. And what I think is the most important fact is that it's connected to N equals 4 super Yang-Mills, which is at the heart of all these dualities. So the way we do it, the basic idea is as follows. Start with a QCD amplitude. Go to N equals 4 super Yang-Mills by using supersymmetry. So you're not recalculating, just using supersymmetry. Use Kawai-Llewellyn pi to get you to N equals 8 supergravity trees. Use unitarity to get you to loop amplitudes. And then you start asking questions about the ultraviolet divergences. So let me just make a few comments. Obviously, I'm not going to be able to say much. First thing, it's a kind of an amusing point, is that N equals 8 supergravity is definitely less divergent than people had thought based on superspace arguments. The divergence is delayed until at least 5 loops instead of the three, and this was actually been confirmed relatively recent, I think actually a couple of years now, by Hal and Stell using harmonic superspace.
So in those previous arrangements of the type where they claimed that there was a proof there was a written three loops, or was it?
No. Always power. Okay. There's never a proof of anything. All arguments are based on power counting. So at the very best, what you do is you identify a counter term that's consistent with all the symmetries. And then you say, well, I can't do any better, so there it is, you know, then it probably diverges. And it is known that, for example, pure Einstein gravity, there is a two-loop counter term, and if you calculate it, you find it's non-vanishing. So anyway, that's basically the level of the arguments based on these power counting.
Okay, but did you say if I strip the Einstein gravity, there really is a proof that it...
Yes, there is a calculation which demonstrates that Einstein gravity, pure Einstein gravity, is divergent. There are two loops. Okay. Now, from these Kawhi Lorentz and Tai, the basic formula, you see, what you learn is something very important, that gravity amplitudes, if you want to understand gravity amplitudes, you do it by understanding gauge theory ones. Now, you know, of course, it's not that simple. You can't say, well, look, gauge theory is renormalizable, therefore gravity is. You know, that's not the way it works. It's definitely a lot more subtle than that. You can, in fact, see there's momenta, extra powers of momenta that get caught into the formula, and you have to understand exactly what's going on with these guys before you can make any argument about the power counting. Okay.
Also, K and T relation for three.
Yes.
And therefore, for loop, you have integral of momentum.
Yes. That's right. I'll get to that in just a second. Okay. Of course, the point is the unitarity method. So first thing that's actually really nifty is here's an example of an inherited property. So you see this speaking of recycling, you'll see that this is in fact exactly the same picture I drew for the case of n equals 4 super Yang Mills. And now I'm drawing it for n equals 8 supergravity. The twister space property is directly inherited from the twister space property of n equals 4 super Yang Mills. It's got exactly the same structure, except it's not exactly the same. The word inherited does not mean identical. It means you derive one from the other. It's going to be derivative of delta function support in twister space. So this is now a twister space structure. The coefficients of each independent integral function, you find it lies on these curves, but not with delta function support, but with derivative of that delta function support, which was already pointed out in Witten's original paper. And the other, this is at one loop. This is actually what got me thinking about this again, is there's a very remarkable set of cancellations that you find at one loop. In fact, if the ultraviolet behavior of n equals 8 supergravity at one loop is exactly the same as n equals 4 super Yang Mills, at least in all the calculations we've done. Okay? And we've done a few. Okay. Now, one loop supergravity is finite. That's something that's well known. This has been known for a very long time, 30 years now. Because no counterterm exists. But you can probe a little deeper and you can ask, what does the degree of divergence look like? And as you increase, here's a very simple argument. Look at n equals 4 super Yang Mills, compare it to n equals 8 supergravity. I increase the number of legs in n equals 8 supergravity. For each leg in n equals 8 supergravity, I put in two powers of loop momentum. That means that relative to this, the divergence gets worse and worse, or the degree of divergence. The dimension in which the divergences would first occur, it should happen here first, right? Well, that's not the way it works. There's a set of cancellations that we don't really fully understand, but I think that this really points to the fact that we need a very serious re-examination of this question. Now, you might also argue, if you know your field theory, you're going to immediately start telling me, but wait a second. We all know that when you're looking at an on-shell object and you're looking at the divergence, when you feed it into the next loop order, you need an off-shell quantity, right? And then you can have new divergences because it's off-shell. Yes, that's right. That's what the textbooks tell you. But that's not the way we do our calculations. We do them using on-shell quantities. Each new loop order will very directly inherit the cancellations of the previous loop order. Does it mean it's finite? Well, that I don't know, but I know that the cancellations will feed in. And that argument, the standard textbook argument, is actually not a good way of looking at things. Okay. So anyway, I'm just about done. So three motivations. We're doing this because we want to understand QCD. We have calculations demanded by experiments to be done. A very good way to think about these calculations is to first look at N equals 4 super Yang Mills. There's an overlap between these two theories. If you understand very well how to do this one, you definitely will learn a lot about how to do that. That would actually be the subject of another talk. I haven't really said anything about QCD, but it's really true. And then from N equals 4, you can also learn about N equals 8. So these three theories, even though it looks they're very disjoint, QCD, that's phenomenology, there's supergravity, and there's N equals 4, they're actually very closely connected from this point of view of perturbation theory. And this guy, the N equals 4, sits at the center. From here, you learn about both of these. We do things not by standard methods. We do things using only on-shell quantities. The key twister space idea that very important is they're surprisingly simple. Amplitudes are surprisingly simple, even for general helicities. They're structures that you can exploit. These structures are not fully understood, but that's not going to stop us from exploiting them. And I showed you non-trivial evidence that in the planar case, N equals 4 super Yang Mills scattering amplitudes can be solved to all loop orders, and I showed you a precise ansatz of what the MHV, these maximally helicity violating amplitudes, so 2 minus helicities and the rest plus, what it looks like to all loop orders, and I think that there's a serious flaw in the standard arguments for supergravity diverging, last thing is I think there's a variety of exciting avenues for further exploration and QCD and super Yang Mills and supergravity.
Any further question?
Okay, so you've argued that for N equals 4 super Yang Mills, the whole amplitude, at least the whole perturbation and loop thing, can be written as the exponential of some one loop. Mm-hmm. So if that one loop amplitude is finite, roughly subtract off the inverse divergence, the whole thing is finite.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know that that cannot be the case for supergravity?
No, sorry. That was about inference singularities. Now, you see, all of that has to do about inference. All of that subtracting off singularities, that's all about inference singularities. So that isn't...
ultraviolet?
What's that?
You said if you know the one loop amplitude is not ultraviolet divergent, but there could still be other ultraviolet divergences at higher loops.
Which theory? So hold on. Which theory? Which theory are you talking about?
What I'm trying to say is that if we didn't know from other means that the N equals 4 theory is supposed to be finite.
Yeah.
Could these calculations tell us that?
Yes, it would. You don't find any, all the way to 3 loops by explicit calculation, you see no ultraviolet singularities. But in a sense, it's almost manifest because once you've written down the integrand, before you've even done an integral, you can do a power count on it and you see it's finite. So these calculations definitely show. They just reaffirm, what Mandelstam and others have told us about N equals 4 super Yang Mills being finite. So the case of supergravity, it's more complicated. Well, for example, one complication of supergravity is you cannot ignore the non-planar. because there's no notion of planar and non-planar. There's no large n limit. Right? So you've got to put it all together before you start making, you know, some claims. Or if you want to make a precise claim, be absolutely sure you need the whole thing, including non-planar. Okay. So that's quite a bit more complicated. Yeah.
So I have to ask you about the S-planar.
Okay. No, it's okay.
I mean, because, you know, when ADS-CFT came along, people said...
There's no S-matrix.
I mean, these are the right amplitudes we should be calculating. We should have been calculating all along. And people gave explanations in terms of you're supposed to calculate.
The very first thing is the object I'm calculating is not an S matrix in terms of any physical state of the theory. It's in terms of partons. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe before we begin, the most important.
You know better than me in a conformal theory, you can't make that symbolic.
Right.
You can't distinguish them, separate them. Okay. In the infinite past and the future.
Right. Now, you see, the most important thing is you have to ask yourself what you're after. And the thing that we were after is the S matrix of QCD, which also has very similar problems with infrared divergences and the question of what are the asymptotic states.
You put some hadronization amplitudes on it.
Okay. But the most important point is the structure of the theory, the n equals 4 theory, or the things you find in n equals 4, you will find exactly the same thing in QCD in a very well-defined place. The place you find n equals 4, and I can point immediately, give me a QCD amplitude, I'll say, okay, here's the n equals 4 pieces. It's the most divergent infrared singular parts. Those are in one-to-one correspondence. And then on top of it, the way that we do, let's say one loop, it's especially, especially strong, this point, is that you can do a decomposition of the QCD amplitude in terms of three components. One is you call it n equals 4, and it sure looks like n equals 4. You can have the entire set of states. Let it not exist. That's okay. You still use it. So QCD can be thought in a very well-defined way as n equals 4 plus n equals 1 plus n equals 0. Okay. And this guy here is
the... Are you writing
a logarithm? No, I'm writing an S matrix or scattering amplitude. So the logic of what I'm doing is as follows. Let's consider a one-loop amplitude. So what happens in QCD? Okay. Well, in QCD, we have two kinds of contributions. We have gluons and we have quarks. So let's first deal with the quarks. So I'm talking about n gluon amplitude, but it's easiest to explain. But it's always true that you can always do this kind of decomposition. You can even do these kinds of decompositions at higher loop orders, but they become much more confused, or the way that the supersymmetry works. But the basic idea is the same. Let's pick this guy here. Here's a quark loop. Well, what's a quark loop? Well, a quark loop is I can take a fermion. Plus a scalar, minus a scalar. This thing here is an n equals 1 chiral multiplet. Okay, so that's the very simplest example of what I've done. I've taken a piece of the quark contribution and I've written it as n equals 1 and then a scalar piece. I can do exactly the same game here, because what is n equals 4 super Yang mills? It's just a linear combination. You see, n equals 4 is a gluon plus a with a 4, and then it's a fermion. and then it's plus six scaling. So saying scaling. Okay, then what I do is I just start rearranging this. You know, and then A n equals 1 is equal to A fermion plus A scaling. And I just invert these equations in order to then rewrite contributions from gluons in terms of... Yeah, n equals 4 is a gluon. Oops, except I misspelled it. It's a gluon plus 4 fermions plus 6 scaling.
Okay, gluon in the next one?
No, this is n equals 1 chiral. Sorry. I can also choose a different basis, but and then I have the last one, the scalar. Okay, I guess equals A scalar. Well, let me call this A n equals 0 is equal to A scalar. So I can invert this equation to rewrite the gluon contribution as a linear combination of this. I can rewrite, you know, the fermion as a linear combination. So in this way, I can think in a very precise way. Let it not be well defined. It doesn't matter. I still will do this in a very well defined way. I think of QCD, like gluon contribution, as a linear combination of n equals 4, n equals 1, and n equals 0. And this is, in fact, the proper way to calculate. And in fact, to all loop orders, I think that this is the right way to think about things.
But the n equals 4 then had the leading infrared.
Yes. This had the most infrared singular piece in it. And the reason is because the gluon is the guy that has the most infrared singular piece. The gluon does not appear in any of these two.
Okay, but now you have this amazing result with all orders and scattering amplitude in N4, where you subtracted off all the infrared differences.
Right.
So what is the meaning of that thing?
Well, the way I interpret it is I'm really imagining that I'm doing a QCD calculation. So the way that I would do a QCD calculation, I have virtual contributions, I have real emission contributions. Both of these are infrared singularities. And their infrared singularities are understood completely. You know, there's a formula that will tell you what the infrared singularities are. I know that these things will cancel. If they can leave behind a finite remainder, when I say I know the infrared singularity, there's still an ambiguity. You know, some constant stuff I can shift back and forth. But, you know, I know what it is.
We made a big deal of the normalization constant.
Which constant?
That if the normalization constant in your formula.
Right. Oh.
So, I mean, does it have a physical meaning?
That definitely has this. These guys, these pieces here. After I do the infrared subtraction, after I do the infrared cancellation, let me not say subtraction. Let me say I do the cancellation between real emission and virtual.
Once you've done that cancellation.
These guys will be left behind. Where's the?
But what's left behind is a perfectly physical, measurable thing.
That's right.
Like a jet.
That's right. That's right.
In anything.
That's right.
Doesn't matter if it's that, formal or
absolutely. I believe that. Look, I have not gone far enough, but I believe that one can define by following the logic that's used in QCD. Is you define in the final state, you define a measurement function or a resolution parameter. Okay, a resolution parameter. And then that resolution parameter, it accepts all states coming in. You sum over everything. Okay? And it's in doing that sum that you find the cancellation between the real emission and the virtual contributions. In the initial state, it's more complicated. It's a little bit more confused of exactly what you're supposed to do because in QCD, we have a proton and parton distribution functions. Okay, so you don't actually know what the object is in the initial state, but I see no reason why you cannot do this by crossing. So you know what to do in the final state, so you cross it, basically it's time reversal, and then the object you'd be considering is there is a detector which is emitting, or it's not a detector now, it's an emission, the time reversal, and it's emitting all possible states. So the question of what exactly the state is, I don't think needs to be answered to actually construct what would be a physical quantity.
So do you think you can define an S matrix in two-dimensional conformal Here, it's different. Here, you the higher dimensionality enables it just to separate. So even though you don't have normal, it's not.
But they don't because of the conformality.
But they still separate. You have a jet going this way, and a jet
going there's a resolution
whereas
parameter.
Whereas
you have to define the scale
going the same way.
Well, there's that, but I can't tell the difference between how many parts, how many.
You have to sum over all states that enter the resolution parameter.
Let me ask my question a different way. This is a function of the Yang-Mills coupling, right?
Yes, this is definitely a function of the Yang-Mills. It's in here. It's the Yang-Mills coupling in here.
And Fn of 1 is also a function of
the... this is an analytic function of the Mandelstam variable.
I see. So all the coupling dependencies in this case.
Yeah, that's correct.
So we could imagine that that sums to some function and continues to large.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking, yes.
Okay, so, right. So now, what would this curly Fn mean in ADS-2?
I was hoping you could answer that. This is definitely not the normal way of looking at things. If you look at normal ADS-CFT, there's no obvious connection to what I'm talking here. The one thing that is true is the basic intuition, the guiding intuition of the simplicity and the resummation, that is from the ADS-CFT. And then also, you see here this the anomalous dimension, which of course everybody talks about. In the CFT. That's a question I wish I knew the answer to. But maybe someone here can say something.
But you don't expect the infrared divergences to just subtract off because they're lined up being reflected in these resolutions.
Right. That, absolutely. So this by itself is absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, we have an expert here on infrared. Singularity. Absolutely. This is not the entire answer. So the place where you find what you're saying is in the real emission contributions. That's where the resolution parameter, that's where you'll find the resolution. So this is not a complete answer. This is not a physical answer in the sense of truly physical. It's gauge invariant. I called it pseudo-physical. That's one of the reasons why I called it pseudo-physical. We need the real emission contributions. The real emission contributions are, in principle, hiding they're actually kind of hiding in here, because we're talking about endpoint. And if you know the endpoint, then in principle you can work it out. But that's not completely true, because you see the word MHV here. It's only a subset. The infrared singularities that we find in the virtual, they actually come from the exchange of all possible states, not just these MHV. So one would have to expand this Ansatz, I think, to these non-MHV cases. This thing is definitely not the complete answer. In the it's a piece of the answer it's a piece of the physical answer along the lines of what I was saying, that you have some resolution parameter, you sum over all states, and then
so really it's a function of cones, cone
yes.
angles, and energies associated with the cone.
Yeah.
That's what that means, makes sense.
Yeah, I think that.
And this is some kernel function that you would convolve with some extra.
This guy.
Some functions associated
with the kernel. I think this guy. Oh.
Is a direction.
Yeah, because these are the virtual. Yeah, so these are the virtual contributions. These are actually, in a sense, the trivial parts from this point of view. They don't depend on the jet resolution in any way. It's the other pieces which really carry the information on the jet resolution and so on. Okay, I'm tired. I don't know about you.